Anthony Marco, and welcome to TV ABCs, where we have conversations about Canadian television before cameras, before cuts, before channels, and explore how the people behind your favorite shows are being creative. This week, Matt Watts. Matt Watts played the long-suffering producer Matt on Ken Finkelman's 2005 International Emmy-winning The Newsroom. He played Matt in Don McKellar's Twitch City, on which he also was a story consultant. He was a member of the writer's room on six episodes of the 2003 edition of Slings and Arrows, and part of the team which created the international stage hit The Drowsy Chaperone. His feature film credits include Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, Fever Pitch, and Don McKellar's Child Star. Watts, also a veteran of radio drama, created and starred in three series for CBC Radio. Steve the First, a four-part dark comedy set in a post-apocalyptic future, features a slacker who wakes up to find he's sleeping through the apocalypse. Steve the Second details the story of the son of the original Steve, and Canadia 2056 centers on Max Anderson, the American liaison on board the only Canadian spaceship in an otherwise American space fleet headed towards the Galactic War. And we recently learned of the triumphant return of Michael Tuesdays and Thursdays next season on CBC. And now my conversation with Matt Watts.
Good. You're better, I assume, too?
I am, yeah. I had a four-day-long meeting in Toronto, not this past weekend, but the weekend before. And I came out of that on like a Monday evening just feeling like shit because it's like the hotel air for 4 days.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, I know.
And I get all congested and stuff like that. So
I can't sleep in hotels now. Like, it's like a weird thing that happened the last couple trips I took where it's just, it's the air, it's the smell of the bleach, and then the sounds of people walking in the hallways, that sort of feverish, because it's also muffled.
Yeah.
When I lie in bed, it makes me feel like I have the flu or something, and I just don't sleep. I get like an hour's sleep. It's awful.
I have a tough time, and I always have a tough time finding the perfect pillow height.
Yeah, yeah, because the pillows are so crappy.
Yeah, they're either crappy or they're really soft, and like you think you've got enough pillow there. It looks like you've got this humongous pillow, and then you put your head down, and it sinks down to the width of a sandwich, and it's like, no, that doesn't work.
For me, it's the smell. It's that bleachy smell of the sheets and the pillow. It drives me crazy.
Like, but to be fair, any smell other than bleach would probably freak you out more.
That's true. Although, I mean, like B&Bs and stuff don't smell that like that. They smell like laundry detergent.
It smells like Uncle Dave.
Yeah, I'd prefer that. I would prefer that with the little apple carved ladies on the dressers. I'd prefer that to just that bleachy smell. It drives me crazy. Anyway.
So I'm considering a start at this point, to be honest with you. I don't know about you. If you're
that's fine. Yeah, for sure.
Well, people have listened to the cold open, cold close at the end, and we can do all that stuff. But apparently, Diane Wilde tells me that there's been this show called Michael Tuesdays and Thursdays. I don't know what she's talking about.
Oh yeah, that's right. We've had this conversation. We talked about it at some point a few years ago, and you were like, "Admittedly, I'm not a fan." And I went, "That's fine.
I wasn't a fan because I hadn't watched it.
Oh, had you never seen it? Oh,
no. It wasn't that I didn't like it. No, I just hadn't watched it.
I know Diane was like beating the drum. She's a huge fan.
She's completely beating the drum. But here's why I'm really interested to talk to you is because you're going through a Canadian television narrative that is very rare. It happens a couple times in the States. I mean, you think of shows like, Family Guy and stuff like that, which, you know, went off and then all of a sudden there was this critical popularity and it came back, and sometimes it was based on DVD sales. There's shows that come back. You're now in the midst of this really interesting narrative, and I don't know if you can sum it up for us over this, you know, I don't want you to have to go on like a 20-minute long screed about it, but maybe just talk about some of the latest developing stories between a show that you essentially had, what was it, a 6-episode run or an 8-episode run?
It's 12. It was
12-episode run. Okay.
Yeah.
And you were probably finished shooting at least 2 years ago.
Oh, more. Yeah, 3 summers ago, I think, or 4. It's so blurry now. I know we shot the pilot 5 years ago, October.
Wow. So since you heard the show was canceled, and I'm sure we can compress some narrative time here, but up until what we heard a few weeks ago, which is that the show is coming back, maybe give us a couple of the highlights, because I think for people who listen to this podcast, they'll be interested in the rebirth of a show.
Well, it's not as interesting as you'd hope. It's not like the
okay,
sort of
well,
exciting...
we'll skip. We'll figure it out.
No, okay. I mean, I can tell you. I'll tell it to you because I'm sure people.
Yes.
Some people will want to know. How did it work? It was off the air for several years, obviously, and it was done. We have nothing left from the first season. We have none of the sets. We have none of the costumes. Like, it's all everything got sold off because we assumed the show would never come back.
So you're going to go for a real Trouble with Tracy look on the...
I don't know what we're... there's a lot of discussion about how we're going to... Maybe Storper will be in a different office. It's ideas we're bouncing around because we've got to try and figure out how to make it work. The gap helps, but I'll get to that.
Yeah.
So since we were on the air, there's been a major regime change in CBC programming.
Right.
And I guess they were looking at the kinds of shows that they want to do to send a message to the public that, you know, we're trying to go for a more cable-like, whatever that means, you know.
That's exactly what I was thinking, though. Before you even said it, that's exactly what I was thinking.
And I think that they just sort of went, a show like Michael. And then Sally Caddo, I think, was having a conversation with the executive producer at Rhombus, and they bounced this idea around of what about bringing Michael back, because it was from their words, it was never really given a fair shot.
Right.
And it would be nice to sort of see what we could do with another year, like a very limited 6-episode run. So that, I think, was what happened behind the scenes. From my perspective, I just got a phone call from Bob Martin saying, we're going again. and it was sort of bittersweet because at that point I'd put it behind me.
Yeah.
Like it was a bit weird to sort of, you know, when it was canceled, it wasn't just the cancellation, it was the CBC budget cutbacks.
Right.
So it seemed like every week there was some article about the cutbacks, and it was my face from Michael that would be the picture accompanying the article. And I felt like, whether it was noticed or not, I felt like I was becoming some sort of weird poster child for the CBC cutbacks. And, you know, that's my own ego playing into it. But sure. it was hard to go through, because it was about me, and it was so fucked up that it took me a while to get over it. And so I was done with it. And then this happened.
Yeah.
And everyone's obviously very excited about it. I took a little bit of convincing to get on board.
Okay. And I think that's fair, for sure.
Yeah, I'm just like, I'm not sure how... I'll tell you, the most appealing thing about this is the time gap. Because since, Boyhood and all his Before Sunrise films and stuff,
yeah.
the Linklater stuff,
yeah.
It's like, well, I can't think of a show that has taken time off and come back. And when you look at the show, it's actually kind of set up for that, because right. It's a show about a relationship over a period of time. So it kind of made sense in a weird way.
Sure. And I can't help but think that real time could do nothing but inform. I mean, I assume that you're trying to get everything back off the ground right now, but as people get together in a writer's room, what's happened to the show can't help but inform, at least tonally, some of the stuff that's going to be happening on the show.
I would hope so. It's one of those things, because that's where I find things really rich. It's like, it's funny that in the first season, the first season's all about the book being written about yeah. Michael. And then the book comes out, and there's one review that's terrible. It's just scathing.
Right.
And it eats away at Bob's character. And we kind of predicted it, right? Because we knew that Doyle would hate the show. We knew off the bat. we just always assumed. And of course, Doyle hated the show.
Yeah.
So I don't know so much if we're going to go into this trying to comment on the past, or again have some kind of weird, let's see, like we're trying to predict how it's going to play out. Because again, you know, we have no idea how this is going to work. Like
right.
it could go and no one could watch it again. And then, you know, what does that say? Like it's just, it's so scary to see how this is going to play out. Like I honestly have no idea. I'm trying to brace myself and just sort of take a back seat and just sort of go, okay, I'm just a writer, I'm an actor. I'm not going to identify with the show as much as I did the first year, because that was a disaster for me.
Right. So you feel like if you're going to, at this point, you feel like the best strategy might be to compartmentalize a little bit and say, all right, let's just ride this roller coaster for what it's worth and see what we can do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And it's an interesting experiment, I think, just, you know, because you're right. Not a lot of shows have done this. And although it's starting to become a thing, like the fact that they announced that they're doing X-Files yesterday.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is, it's sort of a weird trend to bring these shows back. But I think that this show is the most suited for it of all, you know, in recent memory that I can think of. Like Family Guy, you can bring that show back without missing a beat.
For sure.
But Michael, we're all 5 years older, so we have to comment on that. And you know, it would be weird if we just tried to make it seem like no time had passed.
Now, I'm curious. I would say that the standard trope for any kind of comedy is that, for the most part, over the short run of a series or even the long run of seasons, characters can't develop that much, because if a character starts to develop, you get away from all of the traditional things that make the characters funny. In other words, you can't have an incredible learning curve happen. But you're being given an opportunity whereby, if you really wanted to, you could play that up, because so much of the stuff could have happened off screen.
I know, we could blow it up completely. I don't think we're going to do as much as some people would hope, or it would be exciting to see both characters with just big bushy beards, and they've been living in the woods for 5 years. because we just do anything we want. It's been 5 years. But I think there has to be some, it still has to identify as the show. It can't be so radically different that it's not even the show anymore. It's still about a codependent relationship between a patient and a therapist. We are going to push it so that it doesn't just feel like another episode of the show, and the gap will work in. But I know what you're saying. It's sort of exciting to think about that as a possibility, but then it would be a different show.
For sure. Let's come back to Michael in a little bit, but I want to go back to the early years of Matt.
Sure.
I'm doing all my crack IMDb and Wikipedia research.
All right.
And finding out that you're from Scarberia.
I was born in Scarborough. Yeah. I mean, we moved here when I was 10, but I identify as Scarberian for
Do
sure.
You? Do you identify as Scarberian more than Torontonian?
Yeah, kind of. Just because it's sort of, it was like being a kid. Because I enjoyed my childhood in Scarborough. I lived in this area called Bridletown Circle near Bridalwood Mall, and all the houses of a townhouse development. All the houses faced inward. You couldn't drive through. You could drive around it, and you could park under it. But kids were allowed to just roam freely from house to house, and it was a great place to grow up. I'm not a huge fan of the city. I'm not a big fan of Toronto. I just always felt that people. I mean, again, I'm it's waxing about my childhood, but
that's okay.
So
we got time.
I go back from time to time just to drive around. If I'm anywhere near that area, I will go see my old house my childhood home, just because, and it's tiny, but I just love Scarborough.
So what?
I love the architecture of Scarborough too. That's a weird thing.
Yeah.
That's that influx of 70s brutalist architecture money where it feels so comforting to me. I don't know why. I guess it is. It's just all linked to a happy early childhood.
So where did the kickoff come into performing? Was it as far back as elementary school or high school?
It was, how did it work? I was 10. We'd moved downtown and I didn't have a lot of friends, and I was obsessed with TV and starting to get obsessed with film. I had this idea at 10 that I wanted to be a director. And obviously they have no directing classes for 10-year-olds. So my parents gave me, they got me into young people's theater classes for kids.
Okay.
And then from there, I joined a troupe called Young Street Players, I think. We won a YTV Achievement Award when I was 14. And then, so I was just sort of always into comedy, and but my eye was always on directing.
Right.
At 17, I left high school and I started doing stand-up and took classes at Second City and just sort of fell into the community that way.
And so how long do you still hold on to yourself as thinking to yourself that the ultimate dream is to focus on directing?
Oh, God, no. No, that was like a total childhood dream. Yeah. And then as soon as I saw how much work it was, I thought, oh, God, there's no way. Like, I love writing because that totally suits my personality in terms of wanting to be at home and not have much of a social life and sort of isolate myself from the world and create these little worlds that I live in and then live in it for a while.
Yeah.
And then I like acting to a degree. I don't enjoy it that much, but I do like the when it feels like summer camp, when you just sort of go away and you throw yourself into the project. And then, you know, when your job is to basically wake up and shower and then fall into a car and then get driven to set and then fed all day and you just have to do your lines. It's sort of it's a really nice job when it works well. So that's why I like doing that. But I much prefer the writing thing. And then directing, I just look at that as it's just so much work. Like, I could never do it.
So if somebody asks you right now, it's, you know, what do you do for a living? Do you say the slash writer, actor?
Yeah, writer for writer actor, I guess.
Writer,
yeah.
Actor, yeah. Okay.
With emphasis on the writer.
Is that where you get the most creative satisfaction out of doing the writing versus the acting?
Oh,
or is it just a different kind?
No, I get no creative satisfaction out of acting. It's acting just feels like fun work.
Okay.
Writing is, you know, it's what I love to do.
And does it matter?
It's what I have to do. I hate it as well, right? It is yes. Absolutely agonizing, but it's worth it, right? Like, it's that kind of.
How much of a perfectionist are you with your own stuff?
If it's something that I really care about when I'm writing, way too much. Like, I will go without sleep for weeks and harass the people I'm working with to reread every draft. And I'll turn a draft around in a day if I have to, just constantly cranking it out, trying to get it right.
And especially with regards to, I mean, I haven't, you know, all of the writing that I've done in my life. I mean, I'm an English major. I've done a lot of writing that wasn't necessarily for performance, but,
That's impressive. I couldn't do that. That's the thing, too. My writing is strictly like for scripts. My pro skills are terrible. I wish I could do that.
But writing comedy, how much of it can you agonize over, knowing that you're probably still not even going to be able to tell until it actually gets read out loud before you're going to be able to nail it down?
That's hard for me when I've gotten better at that. I trust myself. Working in radio drama was like a real learning experience, because I would write these things that I would go, I think this is going to work. I think it's funny. I think I know it, but I couldn't be sure until I heard it out loud. But the problem was also, burped on radio. The problem was also that...
Don't worry, it's not radio. It's a podcast.
I mean, podcast.
You can do whatever you want to on a podcast.
I'm going on very little sleep, and I have no alcohol in my system at this point of the day.
Well, we're going to have a beverage update at some point, so I mean...
Just drinking water.
Oh, well...
If it was later, I'd have something. But
what would you have? So we'll do the beverage update now. So if it was later, what would you have?
I have a nice Glenlivet. In the kitchen, that I would probably have you
Right beside me, and I'm not drinking now because we are recording in the afternoon. I'm gonna drop the fourth podcast wall for people. I've got a new bourbon that I picked up because I'm a bourbon guy. I've about 60 bourbons in cabinets behind me right now. I love my bourbon, but this is one I picked up called Black Saddle Bourbon Whiskey.
Oh, that sounds nice. Yes. I'll try that.
It's a 12-year whiskey coming out of the States, 90 proof. So I haven't even cracked it open yet, but I really want to try it soon. So
it's a thing that I assume we just get into harder liquors as we get older, because the weight issues with beer, that's the thing too. Yeah. I've gained 20 pounds in the last couple of years, and it's just beer weight.
Well, I think as well, when you take a shot of liquor it's hard to say, because first of all, you can't afford liquor when you're a kid. You can't afford to go and buy a 26er, right? I mean, you can split a six pack with friends, you can't afford to go and buy a 26er. But when you take... It's funny, because there was a certain age around 18 years old, I used to be able to drink anything straight.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't even faze me. And then you hit a certain age where you take a shot back, and the first shot is always like, ew, that's got a bit of a bite to it. I was like, as an 18-year-old? Oh, my God. I remember drinking anything. But
I was just saying this to someone on the phone about an hour ago, that because I went out last night and I only had like four drinks, but I was feeling it this morning. Yeah. And it dawned on me this morning, because the last couple months I've been thinking, it must be the beer I'm drinking or the alcohol I'm drinking. And then today I just went, oh, my God, no, it's the alcohol. It's just alcohol, period. Yeah. My tolerance is so much lower than it used to be.
Which is great, because I can be a cheap driver.
It's true. It is true.
If I can find a way to wear rhinestones, I'll be all set. That's my...
For me, it's just not wanting to feel like shit in the morning. Anyway.
So there's the official beverage update, by the way. What I do want to get back to, though, I want to get back to the radio work that you talked about.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Yeah. Sorry. Let me finish the thought.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
So I often experience in my life moments where producers or executives will read something and they won't totally see the humor. And I've had to say, just please trust me. When you hear it, it'll work. And 8 out of 10 times, it does.
Right.
And it is that, like, the problem is with what I write, the jokes aren't obvious. It's one of those things where if I know the person playing the part, or I have an idea of who's going to play the part, I know how they'll deliver it, and I know how it'll come out. And it needs to be heard. So it's a scary struggle sometimes with people because it doesn't come off the page as well as it could. And I have to beg sometimes for trust. And then when it works, it works.
Well, it's hard to write, especially when you're writing for television, it's hard to write the visual component.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, there's that part. And whenever I think of that, I always think of someone like Norm MacDonald, who, Norm MacDonald, if you wrote out his jokes, it would look like just a bunch of unfunny maxims for the most part.
Yeah, for sure.
But if you've ever seen him deliver one, or you can imagine him delivering one even, then they become funny.
Yeah, it's like the way he says wiener dog. It's not
exactly.
Just, you know, it's like you read wiener dog on a piece of paper and it's not as funny as hearing him say wiener dog. It's like, oh, okay, right.
Yeah. So, but therein lies the difference. And you were just talking a little bit about radio as well. So with television, you're probably in your head always thinking of, all right, this isn't just an audio joke or an oral joke. This is going to be a visual joke as well, depending on whoever's playing the character and the timing that they bring to it and however they look and all of that stuff.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not great with that. To be fair, I'm more the radio. I was so much better suited for because I'm not a visual thinker. It's why I gravitate to shows like Cheers, I think, because if you've ever read a Cheers script, it's like there's not a lot of visual cues, except for when there are strong visual gags. But it's like they just put it up on its feet and they figured that stuff out. But it was all about the banter of the dialogue, and it's not jokes necessarily. It's more just about the rhythm of the characters,
yeah,
and then the humor coming out of that.
So you've done. It looks like, again, I'm taking it from my crack research here. You've done quite a bit of work for CBC Radio 1 as well.
Yeah.
So
that was a main chunk of my career was 4 or 5 years working in radio drama at CBC.
Now, when you're working on radio drama, you're dealing with a lot more exposition necessarily, but you obviously don't want to overdo it. I mean, in the same way that exposition or any character on a TV show doing exposition or extrapolation can become tedious after a while. It's got to become tedious on radio as well, but there are certain things that you have to set the stage for.
It's minor, right? Like, you can. I was weirdly suited to radio drama because I listened to a lot of it as a kid, and it's very, very small things. Instead of saying, pick that up, it's pick up that phone, right? Like, it's just, you're saying, you are having to be slightly more expository with some of the dialogue, but it's not, like, the first two series I did, the Steve the First and Steve the Second, I had a narrator, and because that's very common in radio drama to have a voiceover, right? And then for the third series I did, I wanted to throw the narrator out, but I still had to have a narrative device, and so there was a minor one, which was because it was on a spaceship, they were basically like captain's logs and stuff like that would help, but it wasn't as heavy as it was in the first two series. And I think you can play with it, and you can sort of you can make it sound as less like exposition. It's a trick. It's definitely a trick, right? Like in any, you know, in television and film, there are times where it's like, okay, we got to have this one character spew out all this information in 5 sentences. Let's put him on a fucking elevator or something. Like there are tricks, and sometimes they're obvious, and sometimes they're not. But there's always a way to get it out without hopefully boring the audience.
And I mean, one, obviously audio is a key medium that I'm working in right now with all the podcasting I'm doing. I know that there are a lot of people who, with the ease of doing video these days, they somehow think that the ease of doing video is liberating. And to me, it's incredibly restricting.
Absolutely.
Because to do good video, I don't have the patience or inclination to do good video.
Oh, it's so hard. Yeah, for sure.
And I'm not saying that you can't do great video, but I would rather create 10 times the audio content then try and focus on 1 times the great video content, because that's where my headspace is right now. And to me, there's something incredibly liberating about audio. If somebody's listening to this podcast right now, let's say what their name is. Let's say her name is Karen. Hey, Karen. How's it going?
Hi, Karen.
So Karen's got her earbuds in right now, and she's, you know, walking down Yonge Street in Toronto, or maybe in her car in Regina somewhere, or who knows where. It's a worldwide medium. Maybe she's in Melbourne.
Sure.
She could be there. And she's chosen to listen to this, and she doesn't have to worry about us sitting in our homes, looking at a computer screen, talking to each other. She can carry the story away of just hearing what's going on and letting her mind drift to other things. And we are as professional as we could ever be without having to worry about the spaghetti stains on our shirts.
It's funny is the irony that I've noticed about sort of, I guess, web stuff or like video web stuff.
Yeah.
Is that they, the last thing they think about is the audio component. Do you ever notice that? Like, it can look great, but then it sounds terrible. Like they didn't get room tone or the sounds or the room tone cuts with each edit. Like just shit like that where you're thinking, God, just get a decent microphone. People undervalue sound so much in this industry, especially in Canada. When people talk about Canadian TV or Canadian film and the fact that it looks shitty or whatever, I think they're unconsciously picking up on the fact that it's actually bad sound design, or like, because they don't throw that much money into it. It's right. Always an afterthought.
And
like,
and
you ask anyone who scores in this industry, and it's like they're so underpaid. Like a lot of people are, but it really is a weird afterthought. It's that kind of like, here's a couple $100, someone score the film, and it's just, you know, it's what you get for a couple $100.
Well, in the same way, the home audio person like me, who's got a broadcast quality microphone, but I've got for a camera is a stupid webcam sitting on. The person who goes out with a fantastic camera, the only microphone they've got is the microphone that's attached to their camera. And if they're shooting somebody that's 8 feet away, it may look brilliant, but a microphone being 8 feet away doesn't sound brilliant.
No, it sounds terrible.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to undervalue the work that you know, everybody does in this industry in sort of sound. I just realized
No, but what it comes down to is that you're right. There, inevitably, we deal with budget crunches here in Canada in almost all forms of the arts. And you wish that some of the things you probably can't hit everything, but you wish some of the things would be valued a bit more.
It's one of those things where in television and film, the sound is just as important as the visual, and I don't think everyone appreciates that. So that's basically what I'm saying. But I mean, I do love the audio more as a medium. I just I gravitated to it more as a kid. I like writing for it. I like I like sitting in the car and listening to stuff. It's more compelling.
When you were listening to audio as a kid, were you listening to like old school radio dramas? Like, I remember as I was growing up, I would go through these eras where I'd find like these archives or go into the library and find these archives of, you know, old horror radio shows or The Shadow and stuff like that. And
yeah, absolutely. The library used to have them on record, remember? They would put like records out of Shadow, Green Hornet, Suspense, that kind of stuff. So that's what I listened to. I lived, when I was a teenager, I lived down in Market Square, which is in the St. Lawrence Market. And so I would walk up to the world's biggest bookstore and I would buy these tapes, these old time radio tapes, and they would have one episode on two sides. So it was like you'd listen to the first 15 minutes and then flip over the tape and listen to the last 15 minutes. And they had everything like Jack Benny and The Goon Show. And they were really cheap because they were always in those bins.
Yeah.
So I would grab as many as I could and I'd just listen to those. I loved it. And then, of course, the big shift was I remember walking in the world's biggest bookstore and they had the entire Hitchhiker's Guide in this clamshell cassette case.
Yeah.
And I still hadn't read the books. I'd heard about it. I was a bit too young and I just sat and listened to the whole thing. Like every night I'd like listen to an episode before bed and it just changed my life. Like it was just so, it just meshed everything I loved. It was funny, sci-fi, it was radio. It was perfect. I still think that radio series is one of the most mind-blowing, game-changing things that's ever happened to entertainment.
For sure. And like, well, and the parody and satire that was in there as well. And
it was just so smart, right? Like it was just so smart.
And I appreciate what you said about walking in there and seeing the complete series, because I'm a bit of a completist myself. I love when I can find something complete that I can buy as one big package.
Do you do the thing with the TV DVDs where it's like with, you know, Shout just released the whole Bob Newhart thing?
Yes.
So you had like the first three seasons, but then they never released four and five. So then it was like, all right, I'm buying the complete set. And then I don't know what to do with the first. I guess I'll give them to a friend or donate them.
Yeah.
But now I have both.
Yep. I will oftentimes scour through news releases if I'm about to buy something because I want to see if a box set is coming out.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Or it's like if you see it on Amazon or something and it's suddenly on sale, you go, well, why is this on sale? Is there something new coming out that's replacing it?
Yeah. Like Shout Factory just put out the WKRP complete series.
Yeah.
And they've got the rights back to, I think, about 79-80% of the music, the original music, which is pretty impressive.
Did you have the bootleg
I DVDs? I did not.
From the beta tapes that they've made. Yeah, yeah. I got them off eBay like, oh God, 15 years ago or 10 years ago. This set's great, though. It's amazing. It's just so crazy because you said, what did you say, 80% of the music?
Yeah.
So isn't there that part of you that's still like that other 20%?
Oh, I know. And apparently what they've even done, they were even crafty enough to say, you know what, for the ones that we can't get exactly, we're going to get something close or we're going to get a re-recording of it. I heard that in one case they actually got someone to sit down and re-record it so that it sounded almost identical, but it wasn't the original recording. So it was a cover version and they could pay cheaper rights to it and stuff like that.
Drives me crazy. I know. It's like, it's so obsessive, but it pulls me out of it. I binge watch Cheers every couple of years. Yeah. And now it's like, well, I have the DVDs, but it's on US Netflix. So I just use a VPN and I'll just, because it's easier than throwing a disc in.
Right.
But for some reason, Netflix has these shitty versions that have some music replacements. And it totally takes me out. Even though it's just small incidental stuff, I go, well, why did they... Like, seriously, can't you just pay a little bit of extra money and get it? Like, it's really important to the show that it has that. It's one of those funny things that no one's discussed this about Michael, but we have, for the first season, we had that Harry Nilsson song for the opening credits. And I have no idea whether we're going to lose the rights to that or we have to, I'm assuming we're going to have to pay for them again. But it wasn't cheap.
Right.
But it was so key for us in terms of the show. We couldn't imagine it with another song.
Well, that's got to be the thing, too. So as a writer and a creator... You're agonizing over the right song to put in there. I mean, I think about all the films, like by Cameron Crowe, for instance, that depend so much on music. And, I mean, who can forget Almost Famous, Tiny Dancer? Like,
yeah.
I mean, that was so integral to that narrative and that story and that moment people think of that. If all of a sudden you change that song to something else, it doesn't just change the song. It changes the entire film in a certain respect. So, I mean, as a creator, I have to imagine that not only are you cringing, you're almost self-identifying with some of those issues that are coming up, thinking,
yeah,
if I put
wonder,
that in. Yeah.
I went with what was funny was with Radio Drama, I never had an issue. I had a Canadian issue. Like, I had to, for every American song or non-Canadian song, I had to use three songs. But because CBC pays like a yearly license for just all of these music rights, you could just put whatever song you wanted into the Radio Drama and not pay extra for it. But where it always sort of upsets me is that it's the UK stuff because they have a different licensing thing out there. So, you know, if you'll watch a show on a UK DVD and it'll have one song. It's like, did you ever watch that show Skins?
I've watched a couple episodes. I haven't watched it in full. Yeah.
The season finale of the first season had a Wild World in the closing scenes.
Right.
And it was this really powerful thing. And then, but for international rights, they didn't secure the song. So they had it like a shitty sound alike. And it totally blew.
Yeah.
Like it didn't have the same impact. And I think that songs are one of the, I mean, it's almost too manipulative sometimes. Like you can watch a show and it's the song. People are like, Guardians of the Galaxy is a movie that I go, that movie is a piece of shit. What it was an hour and a half music video, right? Like it was, you're sitting there going, well, who's not going to love this, you know, really well-designed space shot, but with Spirit in the Sky playing underneath it, you know, like it was
the Big Chill of superhero movies.
Exactly. Yes. Thank you. Yes, it absolutely was. It was all the music. And so, you know, anyway.
No, but it's a completely valid point because I think music can get used so well in shows. And sometimes there's a very fine line now where it's funny. You'll watch something. And I even think about movies, Baz Luhrmann was famous for taking period pieces and then putting modern music on top of it and stuff like that.
Yeah. Love it or hate it.
Exactly. And it takes me out.
Yeah. Like, it didn't work for me either.
Yeah. Like, and he's done that a couple times now where he's like to modernize and it just doesn't work with me. And it's being done on television shows as well. And I get it. I get that they don't necessarily want to go with period piece music, but to me, I don't know, maybe it's just because I grew up with it. I
don't get it either. I don't, like, it was, you know, Moulin Rouge was one of those movies where I thought, it wouldn't have hurt to come up with original songs. Like, it would have been fine. It would have made it better. But, like, when you suddenly see these can-can dancers doing it to Nirvana, it's like, what the fuck is this? Like, why? Why? I guess that's the question, is I don't get it. I just go, what's the point? Hire a lyricist, write some original music. It's good. It's, you're employing people. I don't know.
Anyway. Let me put it this way. If Joss Whedon can write original music for a Buffy the Vampire Slayer episode.
Oh my God. Right? Exactly.
Surely you can put together something for a movie you've got a huge budget on.
It's just one of those things where I go, are you trying to make a point? Because I don't understand the point. And otherwise it just seems lazy.
Yeah. Yeah. If, and for all the work that's even been put into it, it still seems lazy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyway.
So can we get back to Michael a bit?
Yes.
Because I want to know what you know so far as to what you know or what you think are the next steps that are going to happen. So have you gotten as far as having a couple conversations about, all right, when next do we meet? Is it like, the witch is at the beginning of Macbeth at this point?
That's exactly where we are. We've looked over all our notes from the original second season that we had developed to sort of see if there was anything salvageable from that. And Bob's got a crazy schedule working on some Broadway stuff. And Don is in pre-production right now for Sensitive Skin. So we're basically going, okay, when can we meet in the next couple months to really sit down, hammer out some outlines, and then Bob's going to write 4 episodes and I'm going to write 2. So we have a very basic idea of what the arc and shape of the season is.
Is it just going to be the 3 of you to start?
That's all it's going to be. Bob's going to write 4. I'm going to write 2. Okay. It's a very small house show, that's it. That we're just trying to find when it works for our schedules, and we're going to shoot in September, and I don't know when it's going to air exactly. I do think that the CBC is going to rerun the first 12 before the second season.
That completely makes sense.
Yeah. Now, nobody saw it the first time, so why not?
Now, in your mind, are you viewing this as an opportunity to, having had time to reflect on the show, not only to use the, what we mentioned earlier, the tone of that gap of time between, but to also say, here's the stuff now that I wish I could have done, or that I wish I would have done. Like, do you have a list of that stuff in your head of the wishes?
With Michael, no, not really. There are times when I think we have the opportunity to show anxiety disorders is a little bit more debilitating than they were shown in that first season. But that's about it. I thought that it was sort of like, with my own experiences, there are times when I think about the show and I go, we didn't really portray it as, like having a severe anxiety disorder, you're kind of white knuckling it through life. It's not just sort of like, oh, I'm afraid of elevators. It's like, there are times where it ruins relationships. It really is debilitating. And you have to balance that with the comedy aspect of the show. So, I think that I might have a few conversations. I mean, I think there is some of that in this year, just showing how debilitating, I guess it can be.
Yeah.
But in terms of the comedy and stuff, I don't know. It's really, it's so, I look at the show and I go, it really is more Bob's show than my show. So I'm going to let him sort of really lead this year and not push my own stuff on it too much.
And when you're putting a script together for an episode, does the concept of comedy to you come from the fact that, do you think that I've got to get a certain amount of laughs in per minute? Or is it, there's a more traditional sense of comedy, when I think of Shakespearean comedy, that as long as harmony ends up at the end of the episode to a certain degree, as long as things have fallen into their place, then to me that's somewhat satisfying and it doesn't necessarily have to be laugh a minute.
I'm more like that. I think to my detriment, I'm not a joke writer, and I've had problems with that in the past where people go, it could be funnier. It's a note that I get, and I go, I know I'm not. It's one of those things that I'll work, I'll massage, but for me, it's more about telling a good story, and I assume there'll be humor in it, right? Because it's like, there's just humor comes out of the conflict. So as long as you have characters conflicting with each other or themselves, and the story's good, the humor is an inherent part of it. And I trust my own instinct too, right? I think, well, I've been doing this long enough. I would assume it's going to be funny. I can't get hung up on that, you know, three jokes a page thing, or because I'm not that guy. I can't write that way. I'm not good at it. Like, it's not that I won't. It's just that I literally cannot do it. It's like, because I've had several friends who've been writing out on 22 minutes for years, and they keep saying, come do 22 minutes for a week, just for a couple weeks, just to see, because they do that with writers. They try them out.
Right.
And at one point I tried to put a package together just because I thought, sure, I'll try to do this. And I just couldn't. It was just, I went, this is so not in my skill set. I applaud those people, but I'm not one of them.
Is it also, and I often go to this next step as well. Not only am I not one of them, but I'm okay not being one of them. Not in a bad way to them, but I'm just because I don't want to turn, because when you adopt that skill set, not necessarily that skill set, but any skill set, sometimes that starts to dominate. And I don't necessarily want to become that.
Maybe. I guess.
It's nice to have it in your toolbox, I guess. But
I wish I had it in my toolbox. Yeah. I wish I had a better sense of craft of joke writing. It does, you know, because I did stand-up for years. And my stand-up was always more sort of storytelling and some, you know, the stuff that I knew would work, which is just sort of like the very stupid, absurd stuff. But I was never good at like crafting jokes. I wasn't good at it. And I still think it's magical, the people who can do that really well. But yeah, you're right. With certain sitcoms, I look at it and I go, well, where's the story in this? Like, it's all jokes. And yeah. So I do think you can go too far with that. So it's about, you know, with my stuff, that's not Michael, I try to get it to a few friends who are good with that and sort of either get them on the payroll or buy them drinks, whatever, to just help me punch it up, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, if you've got a couple of line suggestions, I could really use it. Because, of course, you need to have occasional jokes. It can't just be flat through the whole thing.
For sure. So now I'm noticing, and I have to ask about this, even though I don't know how much you can tell me about it. What can you tell me about Portal to Hell?
Oh, I mean, I can tell you whatever you want to know. It was it's this idea that I had. Coincidentally, it was it was like Bob's birthday, like 10 years ago or more. We were bowling, and I just had this idea, and it was I thought, oh, what about if it was like a Goldie Hawn, Kurt Russell comedy, like Overboard, but directed by John Carpenter, and it was just I had this one joke in my head that. She had fallen from grace in that sort of Goldie Hawn way, and she had
that
been
Private Benjamin kind
yeah,
of way.
Yeah, Private Benjamin and Overboard, and she moved into this low rent apartment complex, and she didn't know how to function in her life without servants. So she was treating the superintendent like a servant, you know, getting him to just, you know, make her breakfast and fix everything and just all that kind of stuff, and then she gets obsessed with this idea that her neighbors are cultists, and he's like, you've never lived in a building like this. They're just teenagers. They're not cultists. And then her dog goes missing, and then she's obsessed with this idea. We have to go down to the basement. We have to go to the basement. I think they're in the basement. And then Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn walk through this basement door, and there's a giant swirly portal to hell. And he just goes, okay, you're right. It's a portal to hell. And that was it. That was the premise. And so I had it in my head, and then my friend Viviano Caldinelli, who's a director, it was right after Michael had been canceled, and I just was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he was going, well, what ideas do you have? And I said, well, I've got this series idea, and I've got this thing, and I've got this film idea that I've always wanted to do. And he goes, write it as a short, and we'll do it as a short. And he was being encouraging. He was helping a friend trying to find something to do. So I started working on the short. I started giving it to him. He had ideas. And then we started really getting excited about it. And then we went to these producers, Andrew Rosen and Todd Brown, and we were like, what do you think about this? And they got excited about it. And then we got Roddy Piper on board.
Which is awesome. I remember watching some of the tweets go by on that, and I just thought, that's awesome.
It was so crazy. Like, it was one of, because when I wrote the short, obviously, originally, the film idea was sort of a Kurt Russell thing. But then as I was writing the short, Viv and I were saying, this is like a Roddy Piper. It's more Roddy Piper than Kurt Russell, because Roddy Piper is more of an everyman, whereas, like, he is the everyman, whereas Kurt Russell plays the everyman. And then also, Rod's Canadian, right? So it was... It just all sort of came together, and we pitched it a bunch of times to like Bell New Media or Bell, all the sort of short funds like Bravo Facts, and we got turned down by all of them. And then we made one last sort of rally to the Harold Greenberg short to feature program, because I still had the feature idea.
Sure.
And the short isn't a condensed version of the feature. It's just sort of like, it's more about the superintendent as opposed to the Goldie Hawn character, right, which is what the feature would be. It would be more through her eyes. And it's evolved since then. It's a bigger sort of like a Western or a mission movie kind of feel to it, where it's about a group of people, the poor and the ethnic and everybody who lives in a like a brownstone building on the edge of a city that can afford to coming together to save the world. That's what the feature's about. So anyway, it was just sort of like, let's make this short that's just about the superintendent and his day-to-day. And so, yeah, we got Piper on board, and in this last time we pitched it to Harold Greenberg, they went for it. So suddenly we had this money, and so we just shot it like three weeks ago, and I saw a rough edit of it the other day, and it was the first time in all this that I was watching this thing, and I went, I can't fucking believe we got this thing made. Like, it's just, it's crazy to me.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's a good short. Like, we've made a really good short where the story is there. It's about this superintendent who is put upon by his tenants, and he just wants to be left alone to like his own thing. And then he's got to step up because these guys have opened a portal in the basement, and, you know, he's the only guy in charge. So he's got to deal with it. And it's got some really good effects work in it. And I don't know, there's a part of me that goes, how the fuck did that happen?
And I get the feeling that, and I could be making a logic leap here, but ultimately I think, it's something like, with all the stuff that's out on the web right now, that's what helps it to happen, because we burst open the boundaries of what can be popular.
It's weird too, because, yeah, absolutely. And there's this nostalgia element and everything. It was really important to me that the thing is, a lot of the stuff that's happening, there's sort of a weird schlocky parody element to it.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that. It's like, no, I want this to be sort of a legitimate short. I don't want it to be making fun of that stuff, it's not even an homage so much. I want it to be on its own terms. But I am taking advantage of the fact that that's really popular right now, that it's, the time is right for someone like Roddy Piper in a short fighting Cthulhu. It's sort of, do you know what I mean? Like, it is that's sort of in the zeitgeist. We're sort of hitting it right now. So yeah, I'm going to take advantage of that. I think what I'm hoping anyway is that people will watch it and will be surprised, because they won't expect the script to be as tight as it is. They think it'll just be him fighting a rubber monster, which is sort of how it was sold. But it's not like that at all. It's actually kind of a nice little short. And I'm hoping the Greenberg Fund is really happy with it. I think it'll be a nice like feather in their cap of a, you know, because it's unlike anything they've done.
Now, what's your hope with, I mean, it's tough enough to try and promote Canadian film these days, to try and promote a Canadian short. Is it basically you're looking at a festival circuit or something like that?
Yeah, and that's the beauty of this, right, is that because it was the short to feature program, we have a little bit of money to write the feature, which we would write anyway. And then we just basically take the short, and Piper's attached, I think, or he might not actually be attached on paper, but he wants to do it. And then we take the feature script and we do the festival circuit and hope to get the money for the feature, and then we just make the feature. Because that's the sort of, the short's great, but we really want to get that feature made. And I think then the goal there is to maybe break the Canadian bonds a little bit. It's the first thing I've ever done that I went, well, this will definitely have some kind of international appeal.
Right.
It's not. So that's exciting to me, because yeah, the industry right now ain't looking too good here. So
well,
it was just,
to be honest with you, this seems to be primed, and I don't, I'm sure you guys have thought of this already, but this seems to be a prime opportunity to do for a crowdfunding kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, no, for
when you've
sure.
got I mean, the short to sell it, pretty much, and you say, we want to make a full feature out of this thing, here's the short, you know, and this could be a year and a half down the road. If you want to pitch in, here are the different levels you can pitch in.
We'll have to do that again. We did a crowdsourcing thing for the short just to top up some effects fees.
Right.
And And I don't know if I'm ready to go through that again. So yeah, maybe a year and a half from now. It was it's grueling, right? Because we're just constantly checking. Did anybody donate today? How much are we going to make our goal?
Like, where's the tote board?
Yeah, exactly. It's just such a crazy way. But I mean, I accept it as the new way to do this stuff. But I also look at it and I go, you know, it's not because Todd Brown, who is at XYZ Films, he's one of our executive producers. He's here in Toronto. Right. And he's one of the executive producers on The Raid and ABCs of Death. And so he's got his foot in that door already. So, you know, putting these movies together with an international co-financing model is there. And it's not impossible, right? You just pre-sell it to as many countries as possible, and hopefully you make up the budget that way.
And having someone like Roddy Piper attached doesn't hurt either. He's internationally known, whether he's remembered as much as he used to be, but he's known.
That's and he's so good in this short. Like, that was the thing. Like, it was a gamble, right? Because, you know, he plays Roddy Piper, right? He plays the sort of big over, he plays the wrestler. And the thing that I loved so much about him is if you listen to him, he's this really warm, lovable guy. And I wanted that for the short. That's the character. It's not crazy Roddy Piper. And I was really hoping that he'd be able to. It's not a lot of actors can play themselves, right? They just and so we took that risk, and people are going to be surprised. I think it's one of the most nuanced, beautiful performances, which is weird to say, but that Roddy's ever done. Like, I just look at it and I go, God, he looks like a movie star in this thing, and he's so good. I think people are going to be. I mean, he gets big at times because it's what the part calls for, but it's in the beginning when he's just dealing with the tenants that I go, man, this is really it's really good. I think people will be happy to see it because, you know, he's done some good stuff and he's done some not so good stuff, but I think people always just wanted him to be the action hero. When it's like, no, he had some subtle stuff in there too. Anyway.
So it sounds like 2016 is going to be a year for you of kicking ass and chewing bubblegum.
Yeah. We'll see. I don't know. With this industry. And it's also, it'll be nice to have a career lift for after the last couple of years were so bad. Right. Without getting into the details, it was one of those things where I'm really glad I don't own a house. I just rent.
Well, I mean, you're going to have the festival circuit. You're going to have all of that stuff. Hopefully all that's going to go successful. And then you're going to have new shows that are going to be on the air. I'm assuming it's going to happen almost simultaneously. You're probably going to have both of this stuff happening at the same time.
I don't know. Well, I mean, Portal will be ready for this fall. Hopefully start playing the festivals this fall. Michael won't probably air until sometime late next year. So,
you don't think it's going to be maybe mid-season next year?
Yeah, because they want to run the first 12.
All right, okay.
So I don't know. There's no confirmation on actually when it will air, but yeah, it might be later 2016. So, we'll see. It's all very good. But it's still all grain of salt in this industry because everything can just turn on a dime. And then after the CRTC decision last week, it's like, I don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Everybody, like, we're all just sitting here going, what does this mean?
Exactly. Well, hopefully, as the Portal to Hell full feature gets made, and as Michael gets picked up for season 3 and 4, we can have you back on the podcast.
Sure. I mean, you know, there's other stuff too. I hope. Yeah. We'll see.
Keep us informed and keep busy. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. We didn't even get to talk about Cheers or any of the. I was in the email too. It says, I just want to talk about Cheers for like 45 minutes. So I kept.
Well, you know what? If we ever want to do an episode about just 1980s television shows, I think you're going to be the person I call.
Please.
I do a completely different podcast on that.
Oh, no, honestly. I know. I listen to it. And there's times when I'm like, oh, I just want to jump in on this conversation.
If you ever want to come on that podcast, let me know.
On Best Show Ever?
Best Episode Ever, yeah.
Oh, Best Episode Ever? Yeah, absolutely. I totally. It's what I live for. It's like a really sad, it is. It's my life is that stuff.
Well, thanks to Matt Watts for joining us on the TV ABC's podcast and talking a little bit about the return of Michael Tuesdays and Thursdays. I think Diane is still jumping up and down with glee. Those of you who remember listening to early, early episodes of TVA, remember that Diane was really into glee at that point. And she said it in a high-pitched voice, and it drove me nuts. But if you want to hear more from Matt, I promise I will be scheduling him on one of the other podcasts I do, Best Episode Ever, and we can talk about some retro television shows as that goes on as well. That should be fun. If you want to, if you enjoyed the podcast, if you like listening every week, please go to our Patreon page. If you go to the TV-EA.com, EA? How did I say that? TV-EH.com website, and look for the Patreon over on the right. You can basically just help sustain this podcast by giving $1 a week or whatever you feel like. You don't have to. You can always listen for free, but we certainly enjoy it. You can find us on Twitter at TV_EH. Find me on Twitter at Anthony Marco. Find all the other podcasts I do at AnthonyMarco.com. Thanks again to Matt for coming on the show this week. Please feel free to check past episodes if you dig what we're doing here. And that wraps up another episode for this week. And now back to your regularly scheduled program.